Step one, you say we need to talk. He walks. You say,
what's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. We got a special episode today, just talking about one thing all day. Monday was Holocaust Remembrance Day. We had our first special episode of the week. I was joined by my producer, but today, my guest and Monday's guest as well, Anya Esther, who converted to Judaism and has studied quite a bit of the history and even done some teaching on the matter. So you and me, we lucked out because we've got Anya here to help us facilitate this discussion. And after what was a day of observation on Monday, today's show is about what is our responsibility, each one of you and me, to ensure that genocides do not occur again, to ensure that each human is afforded the basics of dignity. And we've gotten some questions on the text line about the criticism that is coming from some sectors of the left to Joe Biden for not doing enough in response to the humanitarian crisis that is occurring in Gaza. And this, my friends, is what this points you to exactly the complexities that involve a nation's intervention when genocide or huge humanitarian crises are occurring. This is a question that has plagued American politics since the very beginning of our country. George Washington, famously an isolationist. But at the end of the day, as we bounce forward into today, I can assure you this beyond any doubt. The answer to these questions isn't a president that embraces the language of the Nazi Party, that embraces the language of Goebbels and Himmler. It is not a president that refers to human beings as animals, to countries as blank holes, that talks about the poisoning of the blood of America. That is not the solution. And any responsible person on the left would understand that, no matter how repelled or how angered we may be about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. And as a point of fact, reporting today suggesting that President Joe Biden has stopped a shipment of arms to Israel to help apply pressure to bring about a ceasefire. That's right where we're at in this moment in Gaza. Hamas, a terrorist organization, yesterday started to tell people in Rafah that they had reached agreement on a ceasefire that was almost immediately rebutted by the Israeli government. But that's where we're at. What should Joe Biden be doing? What he's doing, which is applying every means of diplomatic and international relations pressure on both Israel and Hamas to get to the table to negotiate a ceasefire and to try to get the aid into the civilians, the non-combatants in Gaza that they need. Some reports also coming out today that many of the medical facilities that are providing medical care in Rafah and in Gaza may be running out of gasoline soon, and the gasoline that's being used to run many of the generators. So Joe Biden's doing what he should be doing. And if you're on the far left and this is terrible, they need to be doing more, your alternative is the fascist. So don't, please, put on your big kid pants. This is the hard part. This has never been a simple question when it comes to foreign policy. But before we had to take a few important messages, bring you the news, weather, and sports, we had Dave from Madison on. Dave, I want to bring you back into the conversation. If you want to join the conversation, folks, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. I've got a couple other callers on the line. Please be patient with us. But Dave, you're talking about the fact that this fascism, if you will, this otherizing, these first steps to lead to genocide, that's happening all across Europe. And you are mentioning the rise in popularity and power of a particular political party in Germany known as the AfD. By the way, that stands for Alternative for Germany. Dave, tell us more.
Yeah, well, it's not just isolated to Europe, and in the case of Donald Trump, the United States. It's all over the world. I mean, the second largest with respect to population country in the world, China, that's the government there is definitely ethno-nationalist, right-wing populist. They're doing what no one, I heard no one, anyone dispute, is a genocide when they're wiping out, you know, the Uyghurs, and they're trying to replace them with the Han Chinese. You raised a lot of other issues, like in the interim, like D2P. I think it's more of a nascent principle rather than something that's ever been codified in an international treaty, although it is in bilateral treaties like the NATO treaty, for example. We should have a D2P relationship, duty to protect relationship, that is codified, I think, with Taiwan. And, you know, it's also, you know, in Asia, Putin, the biggest country in Asia, trying to eliminate Ukrainian culture, Ukrainian language, all the characteristics of that culture, including the country. And it's really right now is a very, very important time. We can't have Donald Trump. And also, tragically, you know, the European elections, the European Parliament elections, they're poised to elect a lot of these radical right-wing political parties.
Yes.
that I think the European Commission is probably safe. But those parties are going to have a lot more influence. And another thing I wanted to say that I think is very important, you know, regardless of their motives, and motives of by the majority probably are good, but, you know, these protesters who, by the way, after they pitched their Made in China tents, you know, I just mentioned Chinese genocide. Anyway, I hear globalize the Intifada. Well, the Intifada was a time when atrocity after atrocity, every 2 days or so, atrocity after atrocity, bombing after bombing after bombing, was perpetrated against Israel, by the Intifada. You know, I used to go by this place called the Dolphinarium in Tel Aviv. It's just a bunch of kids. You know, they'd get dressed in their ridiculous outfits. You know how kids are. And it was really crowded, and they don't have dolphins there anymore. But anyway, so some suicide bomber and probably another kid, because it was very frequently kids and also mentally retarded people who they would send, went in there, blew it up, and the carnage was beyond words.
That is where this sort of language, this kind of rhetoric leads to death and destruction. Just an editorial note, Dave, using a wee bit of nomenclature that is no longer, I think, what we would hope for. Thanks so much for listening, Dave. Thanks for your call. The AfD in Germany used to be a very fringe party. It's now polling at nearly 25%. By the way, a lot of their power has been consolidated because of some of the economic uncertainty and pain that's going on in Germany. Does this sound familiar to anybody? We had on a guest last week from the Council on Foreign Relations. They published the magazine Foreign Policy. This is Foreign Policy Magazine, an article on January 26th of this year. Across Germany, as many as 1 million people streamed into the streets and city squares last week, meaning about mid-January of this year, to protest the surging popularity and ever crasser messaging of the extreme right-wing party Alternative for Germany. This is what is going on. The AfD's brand of right-wing radicalism is, we've got it here. We've got that very thing here. It is fundamentally racist, Islamophobic, and it's simply become more and more very clear that it is a nationalistic, radical, and authoritarian party. We have that here. It's called Republican. If you hear this and you are a Republican and you say, I don't subscribe to any of that, well, again, I say to you, put your big kid pants on. Let's not deny reality. Let's live here with our feet firmly planted on planet Earth and confront hate. Let's not embrace it.
And I'll just speak to AfD for a moment, Alternative for Deutschland. You know, you can take their rhetoric and the things they're saying about Turkish folks and the things about refugee folks. I'll want to be very clear because I'm familiar with AfD. The language and the rhetoric is you can change it out between Republicans when it comes to people coming from the southern border and AfDists when it comes to folks coming from Turkey or anywhere in the Middle East. It is truly I want to say you're completely on point that these are very, very clear mirror images of each other across the ocean.
Which should be frightening to every single American, every Wisconsinite. I don't care where you're from. This isn't who we are.
Right.
And I don't think it's who we want to be. Karina from Milwaukee, what do you have to say this afternoon?
Hi. Thank you so much for bringing it up. And, you know, I have my mama is Jewish family coming from, and my dad is Armenian. So I know about genocide very well. And the fact that we do receive letters, I don't know how they're finding us for one reason or another to tell us that the Holocaust didn't happen, and although a half of my family died there. And, you know, I think that it's important that the other nations step in and do something and for that reason. But to talk about the history, you know, the Armenian were pulled and protected by Russia.
We're going to have to leave it there, Karina. We're going to take a couple quick messages. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. I'm joined this afternoon by my special guest, Anya Esther. We're talking about what each one of our responsibilities are to prevent genocide, what your responsibility is to prevent genocide. Don't go anywhere. Just a couple messages and more from Anya and Maggie here on the Civic Media Network. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Network. I'm joined today by my special guest, Anya Esther. We're talking about Holocaust denialism, the upcoming election, the rhetoric of what is now a Christian nationalist party that embraces authoritarianism, aka the GOP. I mean, Ron Johnson freaking voted against aid for Ukraine. What more do you need to know? This is not a reflection of American values by any stretch. We've had a couple of very patient folks on the line. Cam from Nina, what do you have to say this afternoon?
Hey, first, I think that I just wanted to point out that, well, okay, when I was in high school, I graduated around 2014. I would argue that I was pretty immature. I still had a lot of learning to do. And I mean that on like a social level. So I know that I would use words that would be deemed offensive. I know that I would use language that would be considered offensive. There wasn't hate backing it up, but the people that I surrounded myself with, they were minorities of themselves, and all of us would kind of just, I mean, we knew each other, and we would use those words with each other comfortably. My point for bringing that up is that when folks tell you don't use that kind of language or we don't consider that acceptable anymore, it's not an affront to you as the individual. It just, it really does mean that folks need to know their audience. It's like one of the first rules of comedy, know your audience. Mm-hmm. You don't go to a benefit for firefighters and make a joke about 9/11 there. At least I wouldn't think you would. It's just, you have to understand when is something appropriate and when is it not. If you're at home and you're with your partner and both of you like calling each other slurs, in my honest opinion, I think whatever, if you think that it's hilarious, right, do it. But if someone random at Dairy Queen in line with you and you're throwing around words that are offensive, you shouldn't find it impossible to understand that it's offensive.
Yeah, it can't. This is one of the, I constantly have a problem with the in-your-facedness of many people that support the former MAGA president. It is, screw you. I don't care if this is hurtful or harmful to you. I'm going to put it in your face. Since when is America flipping the bird to one another and your neighbors and your coworkers? That's not, and truly that only works, right? It only happens when you stop caring about the other person. Isn't that beneath us? Can't we be humble enough to say, hey, I care about other people. I am not the center of the universe. I will be responsible for how my words and deeds affect other people. I will stand and be accountable. Seems to me the entire MAGA wing of American political dialogue is anti-accountability. Are you talking about Kristi Noem and canceling her book tour? Or Donald Trump, who's never going to see actual completion of a criminal trial that matters. Courtesy of his appointed judge in Florida and the Supreme Court. I will be talking about that at length tomorrow because my head is on fire about that as well. But I wanted to point out very briefly some of the constant challenges from a foreign policy perspective that confront presidents and every leader of a free society when humanitarian crises and genocide are occurring. And this is from an article written by Rebecca Erbilding. She published it with PBS Online number of years ago. She said this: international involvement will always be controversial in a democracy, even in the face of clear evidence of ongoing genocide, the most extreme of humanitarian crises. Intervention depends on the priorities of the political party in power, and it is therefore always dependent on the American voter. Yeah, that's you. Who do you want to stand for? What values do you want to stand up for? Again, I say this all the time. We can go back to arguing about tax policy. We can go back to arguing about, do we have too much regulations or not enough, or are they not the right kind? We can do all that after we stand up and say, we will not be a nation of isolationists. We will not be a nation rooted in hate and fear of the other, which, you know, one day it's transgender people and Greg Abbott's talking about how to eliminate transgender people from Texas. I don't know how you do that. This from War on the Rocks, which if you want to learn more about foreign policy, War on the Rocks is an incredible website. basically they talk about themselves as being for wonks, written by wonks, but accessible to everybody if you choose to read it. I'm going to share the sort of the five problems, the five challenges, the five dilemmas that face political leaders in the face of genocide. But let us never forget that at the end of the day, it is each one of you and me and Anya and Cal as voters that get to stand up and be counted. That is truly the first step. And anybody listening on the left that is criticizing Joe Biden, good for you, then show up and vote, because the alternative, your protest vote or your staying home, which is a version of protest vote, that makes the likelihood of genocide, that makes the likelihood of authoritarianism, that makes the likelihood of the debasement of human beings far more likely. I'm Maggie Dawn. We're having a special second episode in a week where we are remembering the Holocaust. We'll get back to the phones and more from Anya Astor, my special guest, after these brief messages here on the Civic Media Network. Stay put, everybody. We'll be back with more after your farm update up next. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I am Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. My guest today is Anya Astor. She's typically my producer, but today, special guest. We're talking about Holocaust denialism, part two of a two-episode series, began on Monday because it was Holocaust Remembrance Day. And at the root of our discussion today is, as a country, as the United States, how do we make decisions about intervening in the face of genocide? Some of that legal framework. But the real question is, what do you do to help step up to fight fascism, to prevent genocides? We're going to talk about some of the denialism theories, but I wanted to give each of you a little bit of the why is the foreign policy question a permanent question, a question that has plagued every American president since the dawn of our country and has been a enduring question, a dilemma that free societies, that free countries have always grappled with. And the first sort of category of dilemma or problem is that the rhetoric or the moral intention has to meet the political reality. That rubber has to meet the road. This is what I think for many of us, myself included, is a bit frustrating when I look at the Gaza protesters. Good intention. The political reality is that Joe Biden is our only path to help respect, preserve, and lift up human dignity, period, full stop. That's it. There is no argument that can be made about that. Not just the dignity of every American life, of every American citizen, but our higher calling to be a true city on the hill requires our embracing, our lifting up of the dignity of every human. The only candidate that can lead us to that or get us closer to that ideal is Joe Biden. The second dilemma is, how far does a leader go, a president, if you will, to push his personal ideals, if there is conflict, if there is pushback from the electorate, right? And by the way, that is not a dilemma that is unique to interventionism. That is the dilemma of every elected official. It's basically what you learn in Poli-Sci 101. Do I lead according to my personal ideals, or do I reflect what my electorate may be asking for? What if those are in conflict? I could offer you a very trite statement here. If Joe Biden had a magic wand, does anyone doubt that he would wave it over Gaza? That's his moral intention. But you have to understand that that happens in a political reality, that it happens in an election cycle. The third dilemma, again, this coming from an article from the website War on the Rocks back in 2020. The third dilemma is that every would-be intervener, so a country like the United States, led by a president like Joe Biden, we either have to assume the burden of basically running the territory, or we have to force the oppressor to stop oppressing. How do you do that? Is that military? What are the very tools to stop the genocide or to stop the humanitarian crisis? That's where we're at. Joe Biden is using every available tool at his disposal, given the political realities, given the pushback of the electorate, right? That's exactly where we are. This is not simple. I could say perhaps in many ways, the hubris of youth, the ego of youth, the certainty of youth, that may lead you to see the world in that two-dimensional way, but that ain't the reality. That isn't how we do this work. The fourth dilemma is over what actually is the legitimate basis for the intervention, regardless of what form the intervention takes. Does it require the mandate of an international organization? We've heard reporting that the International Criminal Court may be considering criminal charges against Prime Minister Netanyahu as well as Hamas. And fifth, and finally, one of the constant and forever challenges of intervention is that what is the good outcome? What a military intervention to stop it? That is more death and dying. The genocide or the humanitarian crisis is already happening. Reducing suffering, lifting up human dignity, these are the objectives. But in many ways, you have to engage in more suffering and death to try to achieve that objective. It is in its root contradictory and complex. The Council on Foreign Relations, we had a guest last week, Dr. Liana Fix from the CFR. They put out a paper in 2009, so dated, 15 years old. But that is how constant these questions and challenges are. It's written by Matthew Waxman. It's called Intervention to Stop Genocide and Mass Atrocities, International Norms and U.S. Policies. He posits this. The United States should take independent steps and work with allies to improve the responsiveness of the existing U.N. Security Council system while preparing and signaling a willingness, if the Security Council fails to act in future mass atrocity crises, to take necessary actions to address them. The major elements of a strategy should include strong but nuanced declarations of support for the responsibility to protect. For you young people, if you happen to be listening, if you're protesting, I will read this again. The major elements of a strategy strategy should include these strong but nuanced declarations of support for the responsibility to protect, a diplomatic effort to work with like-minded allies on common commitments to the responsibility to protect, and a redoubled engagement with other states to explain the U.S. position, an integration of this outreach with U.S. diplomacy on other international legal issues. Does that sound simple? And just, again, to give you some of the law here, the Genocide Convention, which came around, the first signatories started on December 9th, 1948. It came out of World War II. It came out of the Holocaust. And it was finally put into action. It took effect in 1951. The Genocide Convention, it defines acts which are punishable. It defines in Article 9 how disputes between the contracting parties relating to the interpretation, application, or fulfillment of the present convention, including those relating to the responsibility of a state for genocide or for any of the other acts enumerated in Article 3, shall be submitted to the International Court of Justice. And it goes on. This is, we have to define these terms. Well, what do these things mean? What do the signatories to the Genocide Convention, what are they obligated to do? It includes, according to the International Court of Justice, that the contracting parties, quote, employ all means reasonably available to them so as to prevent genocide so far as possible, recognizing that a contracting party may, quote, only act within the limits permitted by international law, and that the notion of due diligence, which calls for an assessment in concreto, meaning of actual concrete documented evidence, is of critical importance. And it goes on. These things are incredibly complex. And if you're wondering, well, what is Joe Biden, what is his administration's policy on those things? You can go look it up. I did. Came out in 2022. It's titled, The United States Strategy to Anticipate, Prevent, and Respond to Atrocities. Talks about a whole government approach. How do we implement? How do we succeed to the ideals that were encapsulated and enacted by the Elie Wiesel Genocide and Atrocities Prevention Act of 2018? Reading from that Joe Biden policy, it says thus, despite international pledges of never again following the Holocaust, genocide, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and war crimes continue to occur globally. The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum reported 20 ongoing mass killings as of September 2020, perpetuated by 10 states and 10 non-state groups in 15 countries. Atrocity prevention saves lives, and given the high cost of response and recovery efforts, U.S. resources. The costs associated with atrocity response far outweigh investments in early prevention. In other words, we do well to stand up to atrocity. We do well to stand up to authoritarians like Vladimir Putin. I've made this very point on my show numerous times, which is, it will cost us so much more to have to push Putin back that the delay that lays at the feet of Donald Trump and Mike Johnson, the months and months of delay to release funding to Ukraine, will end up costing us all more. There are a number of goals and strategies identified in Biden's policy. There's a task force, an interagency policy committee that, quote, coordinates concrete action through a whole of government approach to prevent, respond to, and recover from atrocities. They have factors to assess the stability of countries or their likelihood that atrocity may occur. Check it out. Again, it's complicated. It requires nuance, diplomacy. I don't know Which of the two presidential candidates do you think, Anya, seems to embrace nuance and complexity?
Well, I certainly wouldn't attribute it to the president who enacted something called a Muslim ban.
Yes.
And I think nuance is really the word of the hour when it comes to the signage at protests, when it comes to the discussion of Holocaust denialism. They all come from a place of, you know, and I hate to sound a little glib, but could we go, my response to much of it is, well, you don't know what you're talking about. You hear these unnuanced things from people who know better have to take the time to caveat and say, well, I believe this and this until this, if this. That's nuance. And I think it's unfortunately, it's very apparent that nuance is missing in so many of, if we can even call these conversations, not our conversation, we're doing great, but the conversations that are protests and things, there are a very clear lack of nuance there.
And also, what I would call at times a myopic recollection of history and facts,
yes.
Right? Like, oh, these things, but not these things.
Yes. I'll make it really simple when I see signs that say, you know, we don't want no two-state, we want 48, meaning we want 1948. I hate to say it, but there were some things happening to the Jewish community earlier on in the 40s, kind of the events that necessitated the create of that state. You can't talk about wanting 48. If we're not going to talk about history, we're not going to have a conversation. If we're not going to go back as far as we know and look at the totality of facts, then we're not doing anything at all. That's something in there is nuance, isn't it?
Yes. We're going to take a couple quick messages. We will be coming right back. We're going to talk about at least one of the particular denialism theories. We don't want to give too much airtime to this. We'll take our final callers, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842, and I'll tell you exactly what you can do to help stand up for freedom, democracy, human dignity, and to prevent genocide after these brief messages. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. Today has been part two of the Maggie Dawn Show's observation of Holocaust Remembrance Day, which was on Monday. And I don't think we can do that topic justice without talking about denialism and then what each one of you and our collective and individual responsibilities are to stand up and prevent genocide, to lift up human dignity. And we don't want to give too much airtime to denialism theories because they're garbage. But you wanted to discuss one that has been around for a particularly long time, Anya.
I do. And I want to highlight, you know, in the first hour, I talked about a story. I went to Upper East Side business here in Milwaukee and just happened to, in the same place that people leave their business cards, find physically little pamphlets that were Holocaust denial. And this particular myth is one that was referenced in it. That is the myth, or rather the misrepresentation of wooden doors on gas chambers. So the way the denialism goes is that doesn't make sense. The gas chambers wouldn't work because wood is porous. A gas could move through it. And this sort of brings about a really cartoonish representation of how these killing centers work. This idea of like almost a green cloud coming out from under the door.
Right.
But of course, and that's dark to talk about. We're talking about literal murder in this moment. And of course, they're being very flippant with, oh, a wooden door wouldn't stop that. So I hate to, you know, do it, but to respond to that, it's not how Zyklon B worked.
Yeah.
This poison was developed as a rat poison. It was developed to be put into walls where the rats or mice might live. And through the pellet being dropped and absorbing oxygen, it would essentially release carbon monoxide. It would suffocate in that entrapped area.
Well, to suffocate, it has to be a closed space, does it not?
Closed space, yes, but it does not have to be So you have these theories essentially that are saying, you know, the wooden door alone would have, they ignore openly how many people were put into these small rooms, that every other part of this room was thick, like foot thick concrete, that the officers were wearing masks, all of these things, all of this, mountains of evidence documented by both the Nazis themselves officially, Nazis unofficially documenting things, and the prisoners who were used as labor to man those gas chambers.
Right.
The few of them who did survive also spoke to how this worked. And yet, and all of this is a one Google search away, but if what gets to somebody first is the pamphlet and not someone like me talking about it or the Google search, hey, how does this work? Let me check with a museum about, you know, the science behind this. Then that person walks away with the belief that this huge world event, the number 6 million, all these things, that it's built on falsities from that one thing. And that's so extremely dangerous, because once the seed of, oh, I was lied to or I was misrepresented, it takes away from what our people and many different peoples affected by genocide are screaming for, which is, hey, let's make sure this doesn't happen again.
Right.
This is the worst possible thing, essentially, that could happen on Earth, is the killing of another group of people or of your people. We have to fight these things, however they may show up, whether it's just someone commenting. I have gotten just the words wooden door commented on my social media before. To other people, that's a bot or a crazy person. To me, it is a threat, and
of
that's horrifying.
It is a threat. And this language from Trump himself, from the former MAGA president, he is an anti-Semite.
Yes.
He talks about George Soros in a way that invokes all sorts of racist tropes.
Yes.
These things are absolutely shocking. And I think it's not about what someone hears first, but how a brain, how a person can be primed
that too,
to then accept step by step, increment by increment, increasing levels of hatred, otherizing of racism.
Right.
Right.
Well, it builds upon these experiences. If the only experiences you've had with Jewish people are non-Jewish people or media telling you, oh, they're like this, and then they're like this, and they're like this. You're already working with those three experiences when you finally meet a Jewish person. That Jewish person doesn't know that.
Yes.
You have, not you, but unfortunately that person who's had these other experiences through media, they're going into that with the odds stacked against that new Jewish person they're meeting. Subsequently, discrimination and things of that nature happen. It's really unfortunate.
The brain can be primed for these things.
Yes.
And if you think that that is not what Donald Trump is doing, I'm sorry, it is time to wake up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I want to be sure, how much time do we have left, Kelvin? We got 2 minutes. So I just want to give the call to action here very clearly. Now is the time for each one of you to stand up and be counted as a person who understands history, understands facts. If we think about the degradation that Donald Trump promotes of people, the way that our country was brought low in terms of the way that the international community views us, the way that our debate has become brought low, the conflation of what is in the public interest and human interest with Donald Trump's personal fortunes, this failure to acknowledge complexity, this willingness to speak in the rhetoric of hate and otherization, and the complete absence of accountability for leaders that reject that complexity, reject nuance, embrace authoritarians. We need to hold these people accountable. We need to stop saying that foolishness is foreign policy, that unserious people are acceptable as elected leaders. We need to all say, because our values, our collective values, are that hatred and racism and these things are not acceptable here. And you do that, you stand up for all of that by voting. Thank you, Anya.
Thank you, Maggie. Hey, never again is now. Vote in November.
Yes, it is. I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But remember, it's better when we stand together against hate.